When you flick through the weekend papers and you look in the travel section, you'll often see ads that'll offer a grand tour along the Silk Road. They'll offer to take you to exotic sounding places like Tashkent and Samarkand, along the route where silk was once sent from China into Europe. Now today these places seem remote and exotic, right out on the fringe of the world. But 1,000 years ago, it was just the opposite. These places in Central Asia were at the very centre of the world. Peter Frankopan is an Oxford historian, and he's the director of the Oxford Centre for Byzantine Research. And Peter says that the Silk Roads have nearly always been at the centre of this complex network, trading luxury goods and guns and ideas and religion and slaves and the odd hideous disease. As a result, there were Chinese ceramics in ancient Rome. There were Christian churches in Western China and Buddhist temples in Persia. There were Viking mercenaries serving in the emperor's court in Constantinople. Now Peter Frankopan says that the axis of the world is shifting and the power of the Silk Roads is rising once again. His book is called The Silk Roads, A New History of the World, and he's in Australia as a guest of the Sydney Writers Festival. Hello, Peter. Welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. In fact, I pounced on your people when I found you were coming to Australia because it's a book I'd already bought and read and really enjoyed. So I'm delighted to be speaking with you today. It's an extraordinary work.
Well, that's very kind. It's a extraordinary world we live in where, 36 hours ago I was having breakfast in Oxford and now here I'm on the other side of the world talking about ideas. And one of the things that I think is interesting about us as a species is how curious we are. And we are fascinated, I think, wherever we live, whatever we do, in trying to find out new things and discover them. And it's a real privilege to know that people on the other side of the world have read my book and interested in hearing what I think. So thank you for having me.
A pleasure. I want to start with your boyish curiosity. When you were a little kid, you had a great big map of the world, like a lot of us do. What did that map mean to you?
Well, I was obsessed by maps when I was a boy, and I still love looking at maps now every time I get on an airplane or get on the train. I love maps, and I think there were lots of things that sort of struck me even as a small boy. One was seeing how big the oceans really were. Second was memorizing the names of capital cities, rivers, mountain ranges, and so on. But I think one of the things that made me really excited was the idea that my map in my wall look different to a map of somebody else on somebody else's wall in India or in the United States or in Australia, that you center your map on where's important. And for me growing up, it was centered on Europe. And that's everything I learned about at school. All the books, all the history that mattered was all based on Europe. And there were these huge swathes of the world, these continents that never came up in conversation, never came up at school, were never talked about. And it always seemed to me that the center of the world, or the center of the greatest landmass, the connection of Europe, Africa, and Asia, was somewhere not in the east or the west, but somewhere right in the middle. And so even as a young boy, it seemed to me that trying to understand the world from a different perspective might be quite interesting to do. And so it goes back. When people ask me how long it took to write this book, I suppose the right answer is it probably started when I was 7 or 8 years old.
Tell me about the story about the myth of Zeus locating the center of the world that you heard when you were a kid.
Well, so I remember at school learning about ancient Greek gods, and it was fantastic because it seemed to me quite interesting, the idea that when something went wrong, it's because the gods were playing with you. You know, that somehow you're always the victim of somebody else's sense of humor or wrong pride.
That's right. We're just like victims in a cosmic prank all the time. Yeah.
And you must have had a game show similar to that here in Australia. But we had something called 3-2-1, which the dummy prize was a dusty bin, and riddles were sort of spoken, and you had to try and decode what the prize was, and they were totally incomprehensible. And the ancient Greeks had something like that at Delphi, where you'd go and try and ask what was going to happen to you in your life, and the Delphic oracle would produce some kind of riddle that made no sense at all except for after the events had happened. And that at Delphi, what was sacred was this stone that had been placed where Zeus had made two eagles fly towards each other from either end of the world, and where they met, this sacred stone was placed. And the Greeks believed that was at Delphi. And I used to use my fingers to try and see how on earth, if an eagle was released from the Kamchatka Peninsula and from, I guess, Portugal, in somewhere in this Eurasian landmass, I could never get anywhere near Greece. It always seemed that that sacred spot would be somewhere in the center of the world, sort of, I guess, around the Caspian Sea. So, but this is an ancient idea that the navel of the world has preoccupied scholars like Derrida and Foucault and Sigmund Freud, this idea that there is some way in which we can understand the divine, understand the cosmos. And it depends where you stand to look. And that, I guess, fit into what I was saying already, that being in the middle of the world, maybe you can have this kind of ethereal, bigger worldview because you're closer to the extremes of seeing where people live and how they've exchanged ideas.
And once you've got your thumb and fingers and try to locate the centre of the world from the Pacific coast of the Eurasian landmass and the Atlantic coast, where would that normally lie?
Well, sort of somewhere around the Caspian Sea, you know, slightly unpromising part of the world that we think of today, countries like Turkmenistan, Iraq, Iran. And just because they're there distance-wise, I guess that's one thing. But the more you look at that region, the more you realise that that's where, in fact, it's the kind of like a global cauldron. That's where all of the world's major language groups collide. So you have the Indo-European languages and the Sino-Tibetan and the Semitic languages, the Altaic. And that's the kind of, that's the central point where everything has always happened. And sort of like the heart, you know, the ancients were very interested in comparing the world to the human body. And I think there's something in that it is this center of the world is like a heart where there are the veins and the arteries pumping ideas, goods, disease, pathogens, ideas, products in all different directions. And everything is drawn like a magnet into that part of the world. And in a way that it makes the world look as familiar today, where these trouble spots, opportunity spots, and so on, it's the same countries, the same regions that obsessed our ancestors 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago.
It used to be said that part of the world where the stands are now. I think that's what you're talking about. You know, Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan and Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan. They used to call that part of the world the womb of nations, didn't they? Where like all the world's people or ideas or things would come out of that part of the world. But what was the story you were told as a kid about how civilization travels across from its beginning to its end point?
Well, I wasn't told much. I mean, we learned a little bit about Egypt, but ancient civilizations like the Assyrians and the Hittites, you know, you'd hear in glancing, you know, there'd be something to do with David and Goliath had something to do with that part of the world. And, you know, it would seem very unpromising, but those stans and Mesopotamia and Iran, you know, that's where the Garden of Eden was thought to lie. You know, the Babylonian exile of the Jews when they had to flee from Palestine and Israel to Babylon, you know, that this region, this part of the world is where the wheel was invented, where laws were first written down, where we learnt how to cooperate and build cities for the first time. Human beings, we were all hunter-gatherers once upon a time, and to cooperate, to grow crops like wheat and so on, and build cities and learn how to irrigate, that sophistication all happens in Mesopotamia, and then Egypt kicks off. And so ancient, the ancient world, our ancestors, where we learnt how to do the things that matter to us today, All roads lead not to Rome, but to the heart of the world, and that seemed very obvious even as a boy.
But the story we get, I think the story I got too as a kid, is that civilization begins there in the Garden of Eden, you know, the Tigris and Euphrates. That's where you get the ancient Babylon and Samaria and all that. And then it just keeps going west. It goes from there to Egypt, and from Egypt to ancient Greece, and from there to ancient Rome, and then in the Middle Ages to Western Europe,
right,
and then to Britain, and then over to America, and then it goes to California where it dies or something like that. That's the theory, right? I think of where our civilization. It's always going westward. When did you realize that that's just silly? That's just rubbish.
Well, you're absolutely right. The history of the world doesn't touch the sides after we reach Athens, because from then on, it's just about Europe and the West, whatever that might mean today. Australia, I guess, you know, United States, Canada. But there is no story at all of other peoples. And I think the thing that made a big difference to me was when I was a 15-year-old boy, I fell in love. And I fell in love very heavily with, I used to go away to the middle of a forest in central Sweden every year, and so there wasn't anybody I could fall in love with. But my grandfather had a whole library full of books, and I took one day a book off the shelves by Turgenev called First Love, and I fell in love with Russia. I fell in love with Russian literature, Russian language. I was very fortunate to go to a school where I could learn Russian, and even more fortunate that my Russian teacher had been in naval intelligence and turned up for our first lesson about 15 minutes late, singing. And he arrived. We sat down. I was a very diligent student, and he carried on singing. And he said, "Look, boys, if you're studying Russian, either you are clever or you think you're clever." And he said, "But I'm not going to spend the next couple of years teaching you vocabulary, but I will teach you how to speak a language. And to speak a language properly, you've got to learn the songs of their peasants." And then he started singing. And I didn't know quite what to make of that. But what I did realise was that he was absolutely right. You know, if you want to know what an Australian thinks, you know, don't just read the newspaper. You've got to go to a bar on a Friday night and hear what people are talking about, what really matters. And because I learnt Russian, and then he very kindly he was an Arabist as well, so he taught four or five of us Arabic when I was 17 for a year. The fact that you had these gateways to be able to look at other people's literatures and languages meant that suddenly, even by the age of 18, I was already set up to look at the world from increasingly eastwards.
Who actually coined the term the Silk Road, Peter?
Well, so in the late 19th century, there was never a name for these connections. There was never a name for that bridge between East and West. And in fact, even today, there's no really good name. It's that bit in the middle. Used to be, in the old days, you know, 100 years ago, we'd call it the Near East, the Middle East, and the Far East. And the Middle East, I guess, has now been moved. The Middle East, to most people today, means Israel, I guess, and surrounding Palestine. I guess the Middle East might, for some people, mean the Persian Gulf. But there's no real name for that block that connects between Turkey and the Himalayas. But in the 19th century, a German geographer called Ferdinand von Richthofen came up with this word, Seidenstrassen, in plural, Silk Roads. And that's important because those holiday ads you talk about, we tend to think of the Silk Road as starting in China and then heading westwards. And in fact, it's much more useful to think about multiple connections heading in both directions, because goods, as we all know, when you buy something in the shop, you might leave with your new Nike trainers, but you hand something over to the guy behind the till. And what happens to that money, how that gets spent, what it gets invested in, has its own route and its own story. So
we should see the Silk Roads as plural then.
Absolutely.
Like it's a network, it's not a single strand.
And it's also north-south and south-north, and also most of the trade and ideas, it spreads village to village and town to town, because as we all know, our next door neighbours are the people we have our greatest interactions with. Except, you know, now maybe Facebook has changed that a little bit, but you know, the people we live next to are the ones we engage with all the time. So when you think of it being China and the Mediterranean, you kind of forget that the goods that travel along the whole distance are high level, they're expensive, and they're for the elites. And actually, that stops you thinking about how ideas are changed and exchanged and how goods are exchanged between smaller communities. And that's very important, I think.
The last 7 or 8 years, I've been on this Roman history binge, just quietly, Peter. And one of the things that really surprised me once I got into it was to see that any time the Roman Empire divided and one person was given rule over the East and another was given rule over the West, the one with the most power said, "Oh, I'm taking the East, because that's where all the money and the culture and the luxury and the fun is." That sort of points towards Persia. And this is where you start your book, Persia. How did the Romans see the Persians, ancient Romans, as a people, the luxurious Persians, how they lived their lives?
Well, the Romans thought that the Asia was a kind of land of luxury and where...
Corrupting luxury, yes.
I think, you know, all of us have mixed opinions about luxury. Everyone who thinks luxury is corrupting would quite like a bit more of the action themselves.
Yeah.
It's very easy to criticise people who clear off to the Maldives, but, you'd quite like to go yourself. And I think the Romans had that sort of double standard too, where on the one hand, they felt that it was unfair that the East was all full of, you know, easy pickings and no one had to work, everything just grew on trees and they were all fabulously rich, and you know, the Romans had to earn it the hard way by having armies and, you know, really having to think about new ideas. But at the same time, Persia and the Parthians and the Persians were kind of the prestige enemy, the prestige rival for Rome. So those emperors who wanted to take a stand in the East, they were smart, because the interesting things all lay in the East. And that was not just goods, you know, that's spices, that's silks, that's, you know, high-value objects. But that's also that there's a real awareness in Rome that there are multiple communities in Persia and China and India where there's a real interest in what ideas are coming out of the East. So there is, I think, a sense that Europe always, from the beginning, has wanted to look over its shoulder and see what could it borrow, what could it expropriate, and what could it buy? And that annoys some people in Rome. Some of the Romans moan incessantly about the fact that women shouldn't be wearing silks that have come from China because they're expensive and it shows off their curves, and Roman matrons should be modest and, you know, not flaunting their wealth or their figures. But at the same time, you know, luxury appeals to all of us today as well. And what you can afford and what you like to afford are two different things.
So if you're like a, if you're a Persian, or you're, you know, a wealthy Persian merchant or something, or a, an aristocrat, and you're in Persia, your view on the world is going to be so different from that view we sort of kind of understand of having of the Romans had. If you're a Persian, you look and you've got the Romans over there, right over to the west, but you've also got the Chinese to the east and the Indians sort of to the southeast, and the Raiders at the to the north. They feel like they're in the centre of the world. It's very well to call the Mediterranean is the middle of the world, but really Persia feels like it's the middle of the world at this time, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, that's what the Chinese word for China, Zhongguo, means the centre of the world. You know, so it takes
so
you
we
back
all
to,
think like that.
Yeah, well, it takes you back to your map, that where you live, that is the centre of the world. And you can find beautiful maps. One of my favourite maps is in the Topkapi in Istanbul. And it has at the centre of the world on its map, produced in the 11th century, a city called Balasagun, which is in Central Asia. And no one even knew where that was until about 25 years ago. And so that centrality, everybody thinks that they're in the middle of the mix. And, you know, these, you know, I think that there's always an awareness of wanting to, as the world we live in today, we're all interested in ideas. We're all interested in finding out where are the tastiest plums, where is the best food, where are the best ideas, where are the best places to buy clothes. And that our ancestors are much more similar than we are to them. Sometimes we think. And part of the trick with history is to try to tell the stories about the past, and to not necessarily connect them with the present day, but to try to show that all those same kinds of problems about whether it's refugees, whether it's about inflation, whether it's about worrying about your neighbours, or, you know, whatever it might be, fundamentalism and religion, right, these are the same issues that have preoccupied scholars and thinkers for thousands of years. And, you know, you can amazingly learn from the past if you go and study the right kinds of subjects.
So you're looking back at a globalised world. We think we've invented globalisation, but you're looking back at a globalised world that existed for thousands and thousands of years.
That's absolutely right. So you have, by the time of Alexander the Great in about 300 BC, you're already finding exchanges of goods from the Pacific coast of China through into the Mediterranean and back again. And those same trade routes that today are part of China's signature One Belt, One Road policy, which is an incredibly ambitious program of investment across South Asia, Central Asia, and even into the Pacific region. The same routes, the maps that the Chinese publish about what the maritime and land routes would look like are absolutely identical to what those routes look like in the year zero. So I think that what's interesting today is that the speed of exchange is so fast. That you can get from A to B, you can send emails from around the world and have them in real time. But the idea of globalization is really not new at all. It's just our perspective of history is very much centered on this world of Western Europe, and therefore you start to switch history into a series of myths where we're very good at congratulating the fact that the West invented everything, and then you write other people out of the script. And there's no better example of that than the Byzantine Empire that no one knows anything about apart from you, Richard.
Thank you very much for noticing that, Peter. I suppose it's a bit like, you know, when you're a kid, you say, oh, Mum and Dad, where do we come from? How did we come to be? And you get a story about how Mummy and Daddy met and how the families that they came from, to make your arrival into this world seem special and inevitable, I suppose. Maybe this is what goes on, I suppose, with all cultures, don't they? They write their history like that. Like, how did I come into be into the world? It's all about me. I'm the centre of the world. But if you take a step back, it's very different.
No, I think that's right. I think what's interesting today, I think we all have a real acute awareness that we are living in a world of great change. And we feel rightly or wrongly, that there are major world problems that we don't know how to deal with, or not dealing with very well. So whether it's the Middle East, the rise of China, how to engage with Russia and the interventions in Ukraine,
Islam, refugees, all
Turkey,
these things, yes.
And you know, and here in Australia, no different, many of these topics and themes. And you know, I think that we feel very disorientated about what the world of tomorrow is going to look like. And, you know, whether in, you know, you're having an election here that's going to talk about property prices, or going to where what the future of the next generation is going to look like is crucial. But most people in developed economies fear that tomorrow is going to be worse than it is today. And that has a basis in fact as well. You know, the last 200 or 300 years have been golden rays of sunshine on the West. And my guess is the next 300 years, it's not going to be as glorious a time for that age of empire where, you know, 100 years ago, even Belgium had an empire in Western Europe. And so that process of change means that there is a real awareness that how people, you know, who is it who's rising? What is the history of Russia, Iran, the Middle East? And also, how does history look? What's important to them? So I think it's an important moment, I think, of trying to reflect and look at the past in different ways.
Peter, you mentioned Alexander the Great, and in some ways maybe we can look at him as a great catalyst for this process of interaction of ideas between East and West, this mixing up of this and that and new forms emerging. We have Alexander the Great, who emerges into northern Greece, gets this army, goes charging across the known world as it was, and goes east into Egypt and across over all the way down to India, essentially. What kind of interactions opened up between ancient Greece and India and elsewhere as a result of Alexander's triumphant march all the way east from Greece?
Well, I should say, you know, Alexander the Great was a hero of mine as a boy for two reasons. First, because, you know, he set out to conquer the world and then did so. But second, which gave me a lot of confidence and still does, is that he was a man who liked his sleep. Before the decisive battle of Gaugamela, which basically broke the back of the Persian Empire, his officers all ran around thinking, you know, the guy's still snoozing, you know, should we wake him up? And, you know, he woke up completely chilled and said, look, boys, we've got a big day ahead of us. You know, there's no point not being fully refreshed, you know, get my kit and now I'm ready to go. So,
as opposed to Kevin Rudd, our Prime Minister, who slept like 2-3 hours a night, out of a job in 2 years as Prime Minister. Well,
never trust people who say they don't sleep. And, you know, that's part of a long list. Yeah. I can tell you the characteristics of megalomaniacs are quite very similar. But anyway, Alexander the Great reached India, as you say, and as a result opened the gateway for profound levels of interaction. And one of the things that happened was that the Greeks were, the Macedonians, I should say, Alexander brought with them very tolerant ideas about leaving structures in place, allowing local rulers to stay in place. All the things that went wrong with the interventions in Iraq, for example, where, you know, everyone was purged from their job and you start from the beginning and as a result you can't hold anything together. Alexander was a very shrewd ruler who worked out how to build long term, and he realized that you had to incorporate and adopt new ideas. But the Greeks brought with them ideas about religion, that you start finding Greek temples all over Central Asia. And that started to worry the Buddhists. Buddhism was rising out and spreading out in northern India along these same trade routes. And the Buddhists started to see these temples pop up, in particular with statues of the god Apollo, who was quite a chubby, well-fed guy, liked his food, loved his music, and was in a celebration of the arts. And of course, with Buddhism, one of the points is it's an internal journey, and representing physical images is not a great idea, but certainly eating a lot of food. The whole point is that you restrain your urges. But you can see a shift in as the Buddhists start to engage and say, well, we need to change and make Buddhism more accessible. So they start having tambourines and music with their ceremonies, and they start producing statues of the Buddha that eventually become quite full-figured. You know, the big lads that we see now and synonymous with the Buddha is a sign of showing that that's what wealth looked like.
So there's Buddhist statues that we see are somewhat or heavily influenced,
absolutely,
by the arrival of ancient Greek statues of their pantheon of gods in their part of the world.
Absolutely. And one of the things we forget, I think, in this day where religion has very mixed ideas, mixed reputations, I think, is that religions have always jostled with each other. They've always competed and they've always borrowed. And good ideas, whether it's about art or about salvation, there are a lot more similarities because, you know, after all, one of the defining things, again, of us as human beings is trying to work out what the purpose of life is and why are we on this planet? How should we treat our neighbours? How should we deal with adversity? Why are things going wrong? And, you know, I think that interaction between visual forms, between ceremonies, rituals, beliefs, is one of the main stories, I think, of the Silk Roads, which eventually comes forward to interactions of Islam, Christianity, Judaism, also carried eastwards towards China.
So when Greek art makes its way over and hits the Silk Roads, it pops up as statues of Buddha. What about Greek literature like the Iliad, you know, Homer's great works of verse, the Odyssey and the Iliad? Do they pop up in the East as well?
Well, we know that these sources are taught by in schools and to kids growing up, and we can find borrowings. That's always slightly hard to trace exactly how ideas are being copied, but you find similarities between Greek literature and the ancient Sanskrit texts, and also you find ideas that are in the Aeneid, in Virgil writing much later, where again it looks like some of these stories are being shared across long distances. So you find all sorts of ideas being transferred. And, you know, one of the things that the Greeks had an a great reputation for in India is their skills mathematicians. And that information is reaching India, and the concept of complicated mathematics is being devoured and learnt across thousands of miles away.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
One of the most interesting episodes in this whole story, I think, is the sudden emergence of Islam into the world out of the Arabian Peninsula, which seemed to take everyone by surprise. In no time at all, they'd completely overrun Persia and then taken about two-thirds of the Roman Empire away from Constantinople. And suddenly they're this massive presence. Once Islam comes out of Arabia, how does it then mingle and interact once it hits the Silk Roads, Peter?
Well, you know, it's a very good question. And one of the most interesting and striking features about Islam is, despite, you know, you have to choose your words carefully.
Yeah.
But you have to, if you read these texts and you understand what's really going on from the early ages of Islam, Islam, despite what we might think, is a religion of enormous tolerance, where cooperation with Jews and Christians in particular is one of the key secrets to the success of the Arab armies that, as you say, unite a world that eventually stretches within about 50 years after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, from the Iberian Peninsula in Spain and Portugal right the way through to the Himalayas. And great expansions of empires tend not to really happen very successfully or sustainably if everyone gets murdered and butchered along the way. And one of the defining features of Islam in its first generation or two is the fact that there is a great deal of built-in attempts to conciliate and respect people of other faiths. And there are a great many similarities between Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. Christians and Jews have a very special and protected status in the Quran. That's something that I think is not made clear by those who are inflicting such terrible violence in Raqqa and ISIS and so on. But even in the very early phases, you know, amongst the first caliphs who are following the Prophet Muhammad, you find not just respect, but also reverence for Christians. So one of the first caliphs goes to the church of the Holy Sepulchre where Jesus Christ died and rose from the dead, and pays his respect there. You know, that there is a sense, I think, of Islam's great success as being part of a sensible and soft way of trying to unite people. One of the defining features of early Islam is to talk about an ummah, about a community of believers, where, you know, it's that there is a world that then hardens and then starts to redefine how that past looks. But Islam is carried along trade routes, along connections, and so on, and it succeeds, I think, in uniting because it's able to sound familiar and to open up doors. So some early Christians think that Islam is a version of Christianity that's sort of gone slightly wrong, because in the Quran, you know, you find the whole same cast of characters that Christians are familiar with and Jews are familiar with, like Moses and Noah and Job and Ezekiel and Jesus himself, you know, and outside the great mosque in Damascus, written in Arabic, celebrating, you know, one of the great Islamic centers of worship, a prayer that looks very similar and sounds very similar to the Hail Mary, you know, of reverence for Mary as the mother of God, about Jesus Christ as the Messiah. And, you know, it's later on that the past gets expropriated to twist these kinds of stories to create violence and hatred between people, and particularly here in the 21st century, where religion now, it's either you are either one thing or you're another. But, you know, it's much more productive, I think, to think of the similarities. One of the great tragedies about organized religion is the predisposition of people involved in it to use it to settle political scores. And, you know, we would do better, I think, studying more carefully what those messages of compassion are. But, you know, that's one of the key messages in Islam is supposed to be about God's compassion.
From a long period, from around about the 7th century to the 15th century, Western Europe entered what is often called the Dark Age, you know, where people forgot to bathe and became less literate and stuff just didn't happen that was going on during the Roman Empire. How does this period called the Dark Ages look from the point of view of the Silk Roads, from the middle of the world at this time?
Well, Western Europe dies. I mean, it's called the Dark Ages. Scholars argue, and they think we should think about continuities, and they're uncomfortable with the word, but the fact of the matter is that people stop building in stone, literacy collapses, as you said. We can see from ice cores in Greenland and so on, that level for which measure pollution, that the smelting of metal returns in Western Europe to prehistoric levels. You know, so it really is the Dark Ages. But this is a moment of great flourishing of the arts and of scholarship and of culture in other parts of the world. So the Tang Dynasty in China, for one thing, the Khmer in what's now Cambodia, and across cities like Damascus and Merv, slightly unpromising, I know, but 1,000 years ago, Merv was called the mother of the world and one of the biggest inhabited cities on the planet. It's now in Turkmenistan, in more or less in ruins. Cities like Baghdad were home to scholars and philosophers, astronomers, and as we know today, you have scholars because you can fund them. You need to be rich to be able to encourage clever people to have thoughts, and there's no difference than today. That's how Oxford University, my home university, survives. We need constant money to allow us to go and experiment in laboratories or write books or be able to think. And that's the same profile, not just with scholarship, but with arts as well. The richer the society, the more patronage you have. And all money at that moment in time flowed into the central coffers from Spain and Portugal and the Himalayas into cities like Baghdad. And so you had a flourishing that was absolutely astonishing. And I suppose that from the European perspective, all that happened is that that same process of money flowing into one place hits Europe in around about 1600, after the discovery of the Americas, the European discovery of the Americas, I should say, and the routes through to India, where suddenly it's Western Europe that develops huge financial muscle. And there you have patrons of people like Rembrandt and the great Dutch artists and the British artists, scholars, and universities like Oxford and Cambridge start to rise. But 500 years ago, my equivalent, if I could take myself back in time sitting here in Sydney, wouldn't be from Oxford and Cambridge or Harvard and Yale. 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, they'd have been from places like Bokhara and Damascus and Baghdad and cities like that. So prosperity, tolerance, scholarship, arts all go hand in hand. And until about 500 years ago, everything, all roads converged on or down the Silk Roads rather than anywhere else in the world.
One of my favourite people of this time, we're talking about here in the Middle Ages, Peter, are the Khazars. These are people who are completely forgotten in the West, and they don't really exist as a people anymore. They're such a unique product and such the ultimate product in a way of the Silk Roads. Talk a little bit about them and what an amazing mixture of ideas and people they were.
Well, so across the top of the Black Sea and the Caspian, you basically hit a kind of conveyor belt that reaches the whole way through to the Pacific of steppe lands. And on those steppes, you find nomads tending their flocks and breeding horses and so on. That there are very important sources of meat and horses for China and for Iran and the cities.
It's like a big grassy highway that goes from China all the way into Hungary, isn't it, really?
And living along that highway are many, many tribes. And what often happens at periods particularly linked to climate change is that there are triggers for consolidation where one tribe becomes a dominant umbrella that incorporates a whole bunch of other tribes underneath them. And some people will be familiar with names like the Huns and Attila and the Mongols and Genghis Khan. But the Khazars are one that sit across a huge empire from about 700 to the year 1000, give or take. And they are a tribe that are hugely important for gathering agriculture, livestock and so on into this rich Islamic world. And although they sort of have disappeared today, you know, in the British Army anyway, we still have the Hussars who are named after the Khazars.
Really? Right?
Yeah. They're horse-based, and sophisticated. And tribal peoples are highly sophisticated. We tend to look down our noses at them. And I think here in Australia, you have a much, much better understanding of indigenous peoples than in most parts of the world now, today, I guess, rather than 100 or 200 years ago.
But here's the thing about the Khazars. They were Jewish. They were Jewish.
They became Jewish.
They became Jewish. Yeah. So whoever has done that in the past, no one's. Hardly any other. I can't think of any other people who have chosen. Well, we'll choose to become Jewish because Jewish people know the Judaism doesn't proselytize. It doesn't try.
Well,
and convert.
So as the Khazars became more and more successful and richer, they figured that the organized religion was had its is something that people who are sophisticated have. And the story goes that the head of the Khazar, the Khagan, the ruler, invited scholars from the Islamic world, the Christian world, and the Jewish world to come and present present their ideas to try and find out which was right. And he asked, he said to the Christian scholar, Saint Constantine, the inventor of, who is also called Saint Cyril, but the inventor of the Cyrillic alphabet, he asked him, well, which is, it's a good question, which is worse? If I could only choose Judaism or Islam, what should I pick? And Constantine says, well, definitely don't pick Islam. And then he says to the Muslim scholars, which, if I could only pick Judaism or Christianity, which should I pick? And the Muslim scholars say, for whatever you do, don't pick Christianity. So the Khazar said, well, the Khazar ruler said, well, look, it seems to me fairly obvious that I should become Jewish. So what do I need to do? And the Jewish scholar said, you need to be circumcised. So the Khazar Khagan supposedly circumcises himself in front of his court and orders all of his tribal leaders to do the same thing.
That's commitment, Peter.
That is commitment.
That's commitment, I think.
And it still makes me wince. But anyway, so the Khazars become Jewish, and news of this eventually reaches Jewish scholars in Cordoba in Spain, who say, how is it possible? It's not just there's a tribe, but a powerful tribe. And this story emerges that maybe this is the lost tribe of Israel that are living on the steps of an empire, and it seems almost too good to be true. So letters go backs and forwards, and the Khazars reply, this is how we became Jewish, and so on. So it's a great story, because the stories of the East, the Western versions of what must be happening in the East, are very complex. These ideas of the romantic, rich East, so the Khazars are a kind of precursor of the legends of Prester John and of those who come afterwards.
The Mongols, another one of these people, a Turkic people who appear on the steppe of Eurasia and come out of nowhere, seemingly like many other their predecessors, and suddenly they've got this gigantic empire they've conquered for themselves. They're often sort of depicted as marauders from hell, and certainly they did do their fair share of marauding, but you don't think that's quite right. How do you think we should see the Mongols of Genghis Khan and Kublai Khan and that period in time?
Well, Genghis Khan gets a lot of the credit. Actually, his poor sons were the ones who did all the hard work. But the Mongols, I think it's absolutely right. They did their, as you say, their fair share of violence. But they used violence selectively. So they would be quite, they would butcher the entire population of a city and stack up their skulls so they could be seen apparently from miles away of the inhabitants, and the ground running red with blood. But what would then happen is that neighbouring towns would hear about this and would fold straight away. They would hand over the keys of the city. And the way that worked was that Mongols would arrive and say, look, you could suffer the fate of everybody else, what's happened to others, but we'll give you a chance to surrender. And the two general questions that were asked of the Mongols was number one, do we have to pay more tax? To which the normal Mongol answer was, number one, not only do you have to not pay more tax, we're probably going to make you pay less tax. And second question would be, can we keep our religious beliefs? And the Mongols were very adept at making everybody, sort of Tony Blair type, everybody to feel good about themselves. And he'd say anything the Mongols would say anything that was necessary. So people, Christians thought that the Mongols were Christian converts, Muslims thought they were Muslim, everybody, they were quite good at presenting themselves dispassionately. But that Mongol empire that builds incredibly quickly then functions for the next 300 or 400 years very smoothly, because the Mongols are very smart administrators of empire. They are progressive conservatives, I guess we'd call them today. They charge low taxes. They are aware that the more exchange that goes on between peoples, the greater the tax take. They are quite comfortable about people having multiple identities. They don't feel threatened by people's religious beliefs. They're quite comfortable about being great patrons of the arts, something again that takes us slightly by surprise. And some words in Russian, like jengi for money or barish, profit, some of the words in modern Russian today come from the Mongol vocabularies. And so the Mongols were much, much more than bloodthirsty savages who sort of wreaked destruction. They were empire builders. The Mongol world, they thought that they had a right to take over the world, and so they did so. If you stood in their way, it's happened in one town governor, you'd get gold poured through your ears and out your mouth, and that
molten gold.
Yeah,
molten gold.
Teach everyone a lesson. Yeah.
It's got a touch of the Game of Thrones about it, doesn't it? All of that. I mean, clearly George R. R. Martin's been reading his Mongol history here then.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why Game of Thrones is so incredibly popular. It is telling us about these pasts, about the struggle for power and glory. And, in a way, that is what our human history is about.
So why is there such a dramatic shift of power away from this centre, this of the Silk Roads, once we get to the 15th, 16th, 17th century, Peter? How is it the power then shifts away and the money and everything shift right over to the West?
Well, to start with, it doesn't. But the two key connectors are that the Spanish discover that there are two continents across the Atlantic, North and South America, which to all intents and purposes have been cut off from the other global continents since the beginning of history. And the Europeans find a way of extracting from the Mayan and the Incan civilizations precious metal, gold, silver, jewels, pearls, and so on and so forth. And suddenly Western Europe becomes mind-numbingly wealthy. And the new rich want to buy the best. And where they want to buy it from are the spices of India, the silks of China, the ceramics of the East. And as it so happens, 6 years after Columbus has sailed across the Atlantic, Vasco da Gama has found a route by sea to India. And it means that these ships, which start to get bigger and bigger, can transport in bulk. And money starts to flow from the Americas through Europe. You know, Europe becomes a financial services center, as it is still today, of recycling cash and distributing it around the rest of the world. And that money, which comes through to India and China, suddenly sparks huge booms in qualities of life. So things
like the Taj Mahal, in other words.
Yeah, so effectively the Taj Mahal, I mean, when I was growing up, it was called Cowboys and Indians, but the sort of so-called Indians of the Americas, their silver effectively pays for the jewels of India, because the demand for Indian goods allows rulers to build cities like Jodhpur and Jaipur and monuments to their dead wives like the Taj Mahal.
So gold and silver comes out of the Americas, it's plundered out of the Americas, goes into Western Europe, is recycled in exchange for luxury goods with the East, and all that money finds its way into India and China as a result of that.
And then the transition happens that the traders who arrive to engage with long-distance trade start to find that their resources that are used to be traders, first of all, they leverage that into improved trading positions, which the British are expert at, and then having military resources to protect their trading positions. And those military resources are eventually used by individual rulers to settle their scores. And as one thing leads to another, the British start to go from, almost by accident, from trading partners to being colonizers. And when you find that you're able to control the entire purse of the Bengal, as Robert Clive does with the East India Company, suddenly that balance shifts that you are there to administer and to take what you can out of India too. So there's a procession where this globalized world is connected to the point that, as it happens, the success of the British in India is one of the triggers for the loss of the colonies in America. Because, and this again takes us back to how old globalization is, it's no coincidence that in Boston Harbor, it's tea from the East India Company that's dumped into the sea. That sense that people have been allowed to starve to death in India, it's very well known in the American colonies, that idea that you can be part of an empire but not have representation. There is a real sense in the late 18th century that if Britain treats people on one side of the world badly, it'll treat people on another. And so that there is a rhythm that changes as European empires grow and start to take over the control of countries and states. Then those Silk Roads start to change into something that money starts to flow back into Europe only.
The discovery of oil in Persia in the 19th century is the discovery really of a whole new critical, you wouldn't call it a luxury good, but a critical economic good. Oil in Persia changes the whole map of power in the world. Tell me how that plays out for the Silk Roads, Peter.
Well, I guess at the start of the 20th century, as you say, the discovery of oil in a way frames the whole of the last 100 years. And I think when we look at the last century, certainly from a European perspective, the two world wars are the primary two things we look at. And then the Cold War, Soviet Union and Russia, Soviet Union and the United States. And then we sort of figure that from the last 20 years have been dominated by Iraq and failure in the Middle East. But that story of oil in many ways is the real story of the 20th century, because part of the triggers for the First World War don't just come from Franz Ferdinand being shot in his car in Sarajevo. It's the backstory is really about competition between England and all Great Britain and Russia in India and in Persia. It's an incredibly important, at least sub-story, if not fundamental to the plot. And even in the Second World War, that idea of what the world should look like and who should have control of these oil resources is fundamental. So, you know, we're now living through the end of that Sykes-Picot agreement where Iraq and Syria were carved up and Kurds were left on the hook, and the Assyrians and the Christians, all the minority populations of the Middle East that had thought at the end of the First World War would allow new states to emerge, were just coming through, I think, the end of that process of how what new states are going to rise that will redefine the future in that part of the world. But oil was absolutely fundamental to the world for the last 100 years, and control of it has been crucial.
Peter, the story we often tell ourselves in the West about the Second World War is that, you know, rise of Hitler invading parts of Europe, Western democracies eventually roused themselves to defeat him. Once you look at Hitler from the point of view of the Silk Roads, how does that then look? How does that story change?
Well, I think that the important story of the Second World War is Hitler's invasion of the Soviet Union, because until that point, the Germans seem to have done pretty well in knocking out all of mainland Europe, and things look like they're going just about all right. I mean, the Battle of Britain hasn't gone according to plan, but Germany looks like it's quite well set. But the Germans have two proper Achilles heels for long-term success. And one is the agricultural shortages that the Germans already, by 1941, beginning of 1941, were finding it hard to feed themselves. And second, there's no access to any oil at all. So in 1941, when the German invasion of the Soviet Union is planned, the planners have already worked out in advance that exactly what the German strategic interests are. And they divide Russia or Soviet Union into two zones. One is called the surplus zone and one is called the deficit zone. And that surplus zone is those rich plains of the Ukraine and southern Russia, which grown with wheat, and still it's one of the great grain baskets of the world, and then eventually tried to connect through into the oil fields of what's now Azerbaijan. And the aim of the Germans is to try to take control of what they need. And the model that Hitler has is very specifically based on the British experience in India and the British and the European experience in the United States. So Hitler keeps saying that Germany will reach the Volga in the same way that the Europeans used the Mississippi as the kind of natural frontier, that the local populations will all be expendable and will be pushed out. And if they starve to death, then so be it. So the process of what Germany is trying to achieve is absolutely central. We tend to think of the Second World War on the Eastern Front only in terms of Stalingrad. But if you look at this, you know, if you have two giant pincers, Rommel is trying to get through North Africa, through the Middle East, up into Iran. And the northern section is again, the same process of clamping that middle of the world. So control of oil, access to wheat, control of the Middle East is a central part of the German Second World War plan.
So being really reductive about all this, you can say Adolf Hitler is undone because he goes and lunges for the wealth of the Silk Roads, in other words. I mean, that's very reductive, but in part you could say that's somewhat true.
Well, it's interesting. I've been for all sorts of reasons, I've been trying to work on looking at other uses of spices and in the medical sector. And I've been looking particularly at stimulants recently in the Second World War. The Germans were obsessed about pervitin, which is a drug very similar in chemical composition to crystal meth. And in the course of 3 months alone in 1940, German soldiers were issued with 40 million pervitin tablets that gave superhuman strength. That idea of the Germans being superhuman, it gives increased alertness, awareness, heightened awareness, higher levels of concentration. And Hitler himself was addicted to barbiturates and a drug called Eudocal, which is a heroin derivative. So the Germans had lots of fantasy illusions about what they would try to achieve. But, you know, they were, in some ways, victims of their own success. The reason went wrong in the Soviet Union is they expanded very quickly. And, thank God that they did, because I think otherwise, who knows what the world might have looked like.
Nazis on crystal meth sounds like a really interesting video game to me. wow, that's a wild idea, Peter. Look, you know, we've only got a couple of minutes left briefly, but you say the power of the Silk Roads is rising again. What evidence is there for that? These places look impoverished to me. They've got terrible corrupt governments, presidents who win 90% of the vote in elections. Why do you see that power being on the rise?
Well, I think in the first run, what an economic historian looks for is where are resources? And I think we all know that we'd like to use less oil and gas than we currently do for environmental reasons. But, you know, I think that there is going to be a need for fossil fuels for the foreseeable future, no matter what we might think. So that's number one. Second, that those connections across Central Asia are in the process of being rewoven. So China at the moment has a policy, One Belt, One Road, where its attempt is to invest $1 trillion. That's just what's been announced so far, on a scale that is almost unimaginable. Access to wheat and the commodities that have always been important in time that we eat and so on will keep on rising. And China has its neighbours next door to it who are going to be important suppliers for its long-term future. So although we think of the world today, entirely rightly, as you say, impoverished, etc., etc., you know, China's energy usage is projected to triple in the next 15 years. And so the pipelines that are being built across to bring Russian or Turkmen, Iranian gas and oil to China are fundamental. How that money is invested and spent by local regimes remains to be seen. But I think we're seeing a world where Europe looks to me that it's becoming more and more peripheral, if not irrelevant, because we don't have a great deal to offer apart from financial services. We've got nothing that people really want to buy. We can be sold into. But one of the great stories of our children's generation will be to maintain the same standard of living we have. I can see growth in countries of the East, but here in the West, I think things look tough.
Peter, it's been such a pleasure speaking to you. I know you actually are descended from Croatian royalty and you've played cricket against the Pope's cricket team. I hope you can come on the show one day and just talk about your own life story. Would you please do that, sir?
I'd love to.
Peter Frankopan is the author of The Silk Roads, A New History of the World, and he's in Australia as a guest of the Sydney Writers Festival. abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Want to hear about the best party in town this election season? It's a new podcast with me, Frank Kelly.
And me, Patricia Carvelis.
The Party Room, your essential guide to this federal election. Subscribe now. Simply search for The Party Room in your podcast app.
Or listen via the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.